In the waning days of the legislative session, New York lawmakers took aim at a difficult challenge, implementing a state law that might circumvent the broad legal shield gun companies enjoy under federal law, which broadly protects them from civil lawsuits. To discuss this legislative maneuvering and gun control measures in New York more broadly, we're joined by Joseph Popkin, Director of Policy and Practice at the Rockefeller Institute and the Executive Director of the Regional Gun Violence Research Consortium. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
So, Joe, can you give us a kind of an explanation of the protection that gun manufacturers and dealers currently enjoy as a result of the 2005 Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act that was enacted at the federal level?
Of course. So that federal law shields the gun industry from nearly all civil liability for the dangers that their products pose. So across all other American industries and products like tobacco, opioids, automobiles, civil liability can be used and is often used as an important check to make sure that manufacturers and different private sector entities are held accountable. And with the firearm industry, that has been exempted since this act went into effect in 2005, where there are very few cases where individuals can actually sue firearm manufacturers for the harm that their products create. And in our system of adversarial legalism, where individuals have a right to sue when there's an injury or a harm against them, the fact that this is missing from the firearm and gun manufacturer conversations means that there's a missing tool to hold manufacturers and sellers accountable.
You mentioned that there are some exceptions to the current federal law. What are those exceptions?
The six broad exceptions are when someone has been convicted of knowingly transferring a firearm to be used in a crime, the negligence of an individual or a seller, and also a violation of a federal or state statute that's applicable to the sale or marketing of the product. So there's a few like fact-specific patterns where individuals can try to create a suit that meets a very narrow confine, but it acts as a funnel in actually developing a case that can go forward against any gun manufacturer. And so the novelty in the bill that recently passed the legislature here in New York is that it tries to make explicit that suits can proceed against gun manufacturers if they have inappropriately sold or marketed their products, and that inappropriateness created a cause for harm, meaning the manufacturer did not adequately put in place protections to protect against theft of firearms, or that those firearms were then passed through dealers to individuals who are prohibited from having them. So it really tries to create a new state standard for lawsuits to proceed against manufacturers where they may not have gone above and beyond to make sure that their products didn't end up in the hands of people who then use them to commit violent acts.
So what is it about having a federal law, though, that requires the state to create its own sort of workaround? And why does this need to actually be enshrined into state law? Is this basically a reminder to judges that this is a legal course of action that they can allow these types of cases to be brought?
I don't know that it's a reminder to judges so much as it is a new avenue to allow states and local governments and individuals to pursue lawsuits against gun manufacturers. And so, you know, right now there is very limited, narrow ways in which you can do that we've talked a little bit about. And opening that aperture, opening up broader challenges is not possible given that federal law is in effect. And so you have President Biden during his campaign calling for the repeal of the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. He has now last week talked about, again, renewing calls for Congress to repeal it because it is a protection that is only afforded to firearm manufacturers and almost no other industry. And then the other thing that he announced last week was, you know, convening state attorney generals and state lawmakers to try to, in some ways, create a new legal landscape where state statutes can give people the ability to pierce this immunity shield. And so New York's law really, you know, is leading the way in terms of what is likely to be an ongoing legal battle, and one that is going to face a lot of challenges, but is certainly going to be a conversation starter in terms of, you know, is this a new way for bringing manufacturers along to change their behavior, change their marketing and sales practices, encourage or require them to do safe storage, provide more accountability of the, you know, sellers and the other people who actually are the ones who sell their products in transactions to individuals. So I think, you know, it is in some ways taking advantage of our federal system of government to have states leading the way. And that's going to be the case so long as this federal law is in effect.
During the assembly debate on this bill, a upstate Republican, in explaining their opposition, argued that this legislation would violate the Second Amendment if enacted. What's your response to that?
Well, not a lawmaker myself, but I think that, you know, the Second Amendment is always open to reasonable regulations. It's not an unlimited right. And that is what the Supreme Court, you know, said in their decision in 2008 with Heller, which established a right of ownership for the protection of an individual within their own home. I think that in general, the Second Amendment is a reflection of where we are as a society, what the public wants, what the public is electing the representatives to seek. So I don't know that it is out of hand unconstitutional. I do think there are other challenges, though. You know, there could be opposition, and this has been articulated in some memos and also brought up in some of the debate. You know, does this new law violate the will of Congress? Is it too vague, you know, in terms of establishing what reasonable conduct would be for a manufacturer to ensure their products don't cause harm? And then the Commerce Clause, you know, how do we hold out-of-state sellers accountable? Somebody who is a federally licensed firearms dealer in Pennsylvania selling to somebody who then brings that weapon into New York. So I think there are a lot of legal challenges that are likely to arise, but it is certainly a conversation worth having given the fact that, you know, for so long this industry didn't enjoy these protections and now does, and that has created and stymied some of the manufacturers from, you know, taking measures and steps to make sure that gun violence in this country is appropriately curbed.
You mentioned the potential ambiguity surrounding the reasonable conduct provision of this legislation. Is there a clear example that you think would be covered by this statute? And what's an example that you think might be more nebulous in terms of where it falls on this legislation?
The legislation requires all gun industry members, you know, and it's defined as those who are engaging in the sale, manufacturing, import, distribution of firearms and ammo, to establish and utilize policies that prevent theft of their products, as well as ensure that the sales go to qualified individuals, meaning people who are lawfully able to purchase and possess firearms. You know, a reasonable one, and one that I think is kind of well-established law and policy, is around safe storage, right? You know, is a manufacturer or a seller abiding by safe storage protocols? Are they storing ammunition separately from the firearms? That seems to be, you know, a reasonable standard around which people can create policies and have programs in place and work from existing template. Potentially less clear fact pattern is looking at the fact that a majority of the firearms used in crimes in New York have come from out of state, up from Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, through the Iron Pipeline, and starting to think about how you hold a manufacturer accountable for a firearm that they are selling en masse to potentially a federally licensed firearm dealer in a different state, who then sells to an individual who takes the weapons and engages in a straw purchase to then travel across state lines and provide that weapon to somebody else. I think that is dismantling that pipeline is going to be important, and it continues to be a struggle that the ATF and state and local law enforcement engage in every day. And I think reasonable minds can disagree in terms of how you start to hold the manufacturers accountable for that, particularly, you know, given how many people are involved in the different points in the process. Again, however, I think it's it's important that, you know, the conversation is had, because every step along the way, there are opportunities to interdict these firearms and prevent them from going into the wrong hands.
You talked about abiding by safe storage practices, and in New York, we have laws governing what gun owners are required to do in terms of storage if they have a minor in the home or a minor might have access to a gun. But for adults who are not in that situation, they're not legally obligated to do anything. So what would the threshold be that gun manufacturers and dealers would need to comply with? Is there some sort of reasonable storage that gun owners generally accept as being reasonable? And why should gun manufacturers in general be responsible for how people store their guns?
That's a great question. So I think that gets to a little bit of the vagueness or arguments that could be made against the bill or a statutory challenge that could arise. I think in general, the closest reading of it would be the manufacturers, while their product is in their possession or when they've provided it to a seller, ensuring that the sellers are abiding by safe storage protocols and are not creating the conditions where their firearms could be stolen or subject to theft, is probably the most direct case and fact pattern. However, you know, there could be manufacturers who then feel as if they have to avoid liability, promote within the gun ownership community safe storage practices writ large. So I think, you know, it is a second or third order effect. And I think if this bill becomes law, they'll probably be foremost, you know, concerned of the guns that are still in their control or in the control of the people who will be selling them. But it does open the door to, are there manufacturer responsibilities or obligations for their products as they get into the hands of people who are then have them in their home? It is to be seen, I guess, is the best answer to the question.
So this is a hypothetical question, but in the future, as technology develops, could gun manufacturers be held responsible for not utilizing, I guess, whatever is the most current safety technology, maybe a gun ID mechanism, which ensures it only fires in the owner's hands? I mean, is there that sort of civil liability for not implementing best practices like that?
I think it's plausible. I think the one thing that we have seen over the last few years is emerging technologies around guns, you know, ghost guns, the 80% lower receivers. The technology on the firearm side continues to evolve, and with it, the conversation around safety mechanisms. And so New Jersey, you know, a long time ago had a statute that talked about gun safety measures and biometric locks, and that has largely been left alone and not fully implemented. And when the current governor, Governor Andrew Cuomo, was HUD secretary, he had worked with the Treasury Department to get a code of conduct agreement with Smith & Wesson that also had some gun safety lock provisions that were a part of the agreement. And so I think the conversation around gun safety technologies has been evolving for the last 20 years and is likely going to continue to evolve. I don't know that this bill, if it became law, would immediately, you know, require that. But I think that that could open up manufacturers to legal challenges to say, what are the reasons why you haven't adopted or offered firearms with this level of protection as a consumer safety measure? And that would then be incumbent upon the manufacturer to have a defense to that potential allegation.
And after a quick break, we'll have more with our guest, Joe Popkin, Director of Policy and Practice at the Rockefeller Institute and the Executive Director of the Regional Gun Violence Research Consortium.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by the New York State AFL-CIO, a federation of 3,000 unions fighting for working people by keeping New York State union strong. UnionStrongNY.com for more information.
In case you're just joining us, you're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're continuing our discussion about a potential state law which has made its way through the legislature and is still waiting to be signed by the governor, which would allow gun manufacturers and gun dealers to face civil actions in New York. And our guest is Joe Popkin, Director of Policy and Practice at the Rockefeller Institute and the Executive Director of the Regional Gun Violence Research Consortium. We've talked in this conversation about the iron pipeline, which results in guns coming here from other states, which likely have looser gun purchase laws. And you suggested that the state's law may be used to penalize operators in other states. Why are you optimistic about that? Because that really sounds like a uphill battle for New York.
I think that is one of the challenges, but it also is likely that, you know, the bill itself does provide some consistency to say, you know, it's not about the location of where the, you know, liability or the harm is incurred. It's really about the industry writ large. And so if their products knowingly or recklessly endanger public safety in New York, then it might not matter where they were manufactured, marketed, imported, or sold. And so that it is likely going to be a challenge, but the Interstate Commerce Clause really sets a high bar in terms of whether or not it presents a, you know, clearly excessive burden to the otherwise local benefits that New York would have from having the law. So it would be incumbent upon, you know, the lawyers in the case and ultimately the judge and which federal court heard the case to be able to decide whether or not it could withstand that challenge. So I think it's more of a legal question in a lot of ways than it is an operational one. And given the, you know, dramatic problem of guns from other states kind of proliferating through the states with stronger gun laws, I think it's you know, definitely an area where the advocates and a lot of research is being channeled.
If this measure becomes law and withstands any legal scrutiny, do you envision it serving as a deterrent that changes behavior, or will it take some big civil cases that are successful to alter business practices in the gun industry?
Throughout the criminal justice system, we've had changes like Raise the Age or bail reform, and we have seen before those laws are even adopted and on the books, that behaviors change. And so I think that there is a likelihood that even just having the conversation around removal or curtailing this blanket immunity for the gun industry may likely spur change within the gun industry to say, here is a code of conduct that we all agree to, or here is the best principles that we are going to apply, because they, you know, recognize that their products, which are being sold in record numbers, have a likelihood of falling into the wrong hands and being used in violent crime. And so I think the conversation and the discourse itself is likely to spur some change. And then obviously once the law is on the books and if it's upheld and withstands legal scrutiny, then a landmark case not dissimilar from the case that was announced on opioids recently, you know, could fuel further action or create an even more strict level of behavior.
The push for this legislation comes amid what appears, at least anecdotally, to be another violent year for New York. What does the data, though, tell us about the number of shootings in 2021 and 2020, and how does it compare to pre-pandemic years?
There's no doubt that we are seeing a surge of gun violence in New York. In New York City, from 2019 to 2020, we saw a 97% increase in shootings. Throughout the rest of state, we saw a 75% increase in shooting incidents that involved injury. And so that was the year-to-year increases. And already this year, we've seen a 53% increase in shootings in New York City and a 42% increase in shooting incidents in rest of state. So you have really a, you know, more than doubling of where we were in 2019 before the pandemic. But those levels are still significantly lower than they were in the 90s amid that record crime wave. For instance, right now, We're about 70% below the 1993 levels of shooting victims and incidents, and 76% below the 1993 level of murders in New York City. And firearm-involved crimes throughout the rest of the state has returned really to a 2013-2014 level. So it is definitely increasing in a problematic ways, in ways that are being captured by the press and policymakers and law enforcement, but it has not returned to a level of violence that was seen in the 90s.
Is there any obvious answer as to why we're seeing a spike in gun violence in New York and nationally? Is it just a product of the pandemic?
So the simplest answer is no one knows. There are theories that need to be evaluated. And so the three kind of leading theories are, one is the socioeconomic impact of COVID-19. You have unemployment, poverty in persistent pockets that are creating lack of opportunity. You have the pressures of, you know, social isolation, which have led to substance abuse, domestic violence. And then you have the shutdown of safe spaces like schools and services where you could see the individuals engaged in positive development and not necessarily ensnared in violence in the streets. And so the socioeconomic impact of COVID is certainly a part of the equation and is one that public health researchers have focused on. Another one is just a record increase in gun sales, which we talked a little bit about, but the proliferation is really at a record-setting level. Roughly 22 to 23 million guns were sold in 2020, which was a nearly 70% increase from the year before. And just to put that figure in perspective, there were only 5 months from 2000 to 2019 where there were more than 1.5 million firearms sold. In 2020, 9 months exceeded that volume of sales. And so far this year, 4 months have surpassed that level of being more than 1.5 million firearms sold within the month. So there's obviously a lot more firearms being sold. And there's some evidence to suggest that it is new gun owners that are purchasing those firearms. And then the last one, which has been talked about in kind of a political context, are changes to the criminal justice system writ large over the last few years. Things like bail reform, decriminalization of minor offenses, the conversation around policing, you know, whether or not there's fewer resources for police, individuals retiring, the forces starting to get smaller in size. So there are a lot of theories. It does not seem to be that there's evidence to support one specific one at this point, and it's probably going to take years before we exactly know what are the causes and consequences of the firearm violence that happened last year and what's happened this year.
Considering that the criminal justice reforms in New York that have been implemented since 2019 deal with relatively minor offenses, for example, you know, decriminalizing low-level drug arrests and getting rid of cash bail for nonviolent crimes, if those laws are responsible for any increase in gun violence, wouldn't that mean then that the people who are getting arrested for low-level crimes or are getting violations for low-level crimes are then dramatically escalating their criminal behavior? And if that's the case, does that seem like a realistic argument to you?
I have not seen evidence to suggest that bail reform and the release of people from pretrial detention has led to direct incidents of violence. So I do think it is difficult to, you know, make that assertion at this point, partially because, you know, the data continues to come out, but also because of the fact that the crime that we're seeing now involving firearms is not just specific to New York, right? This is a part of a larger national trend in firearm violence, and it's happening in red states and blue states. It's happening in, you know, large cities, but also small cities. And it's happening in places where there haven't been any criminal justice reform changes. So it does seem to be a little bit difficult at this point to say that changes to pretrial procedures have created the conditions under which there's more violence.
As we try to wrap our heads around this increase, which, like you say, is still below the peaks that we saw in the last 30 years, is there any sort of data that you would love to have that just isn't being collected or isn't being collected well?
So I think in general, data on firearms across the country is is spotty, right? And so you have a lot of different data collection systems that are set up that don't naturally talk to one another. And part of that is the product of, you know, our federal system of government. You have ATF, which, you know, controls certain records and has largely had their hands tied in terms of creating modern record management systems. And that's through the fact that they're funded by Congress, and Congress has put in certain restrictions on them creating that type of data tracking system. And at the state level, it is about the types of, you know, data that you're collected and really the definitions that you're using. So if one jurisdiction is tracking shooting incidents involving injury, but another is tracking shooting incidents that are leading to fatalities, you know, there's not always a one-to-one. So a lot of it is not for lack of data being out there. It's creating the conditions under which that data is shared and can talk to one another so that you can have an accurate picture of the toll of gun violence within each community. I mean, and it's easy when we start to zoom out and look at the federal level. We can say, you know, gun violence is devastating families and communities. We know that it's injuring more than 80,000 a year and claiming the lives of nearly 40,000 people each year. And we know that more people are dying now from firearms and motor vehicle crashes. But when you start to get to a conversation around states, local governments, you know, counties, down to specific neighborhoods, it's harder and harder to be able to distill those findings and use that information to drive insights. And so I think the problem isn't necessarily that the data isn't out there. It's that we need to do better in collecting it, organizing it, and providing it to the hands of policymakers who can drive change in their community. Because the problem of gun violence starts local, and it needs to end ultimately at the local level.
And finally, I'm just curious. Obviously, we've been having this whole conversation about guns, gun policy. But I'm curious, what's your like personal familiarity with guns? And you know, you don't need to answer this, but like, are you a gun owner, for example?
So my family has owned guns. My dad is in the military, and so I've, you know, gone shooting a bunch and definitely have been exposed to firearms throughout my life. But right now I have a child in the home. I'm not a current gun owner. And, you know, I think roughly one-third of Americans own guns, according to the most recent research. And that number seems to be growing based on the pandemic. But I think my personal view on the gun violence crisis is that it's incumbent upon everybody, wherever they're sitting, whether they own guns or not, to have a stake in preventing violence, whether that community is their community of their city they live in, the county, or the state, or just broadly the nation. And I think from our perspective within the Regional Gun Violence Research Consortium, we try to organize across the different states researchers from public health, from criminal justice, to be able to bring their expertise and insights to provide that information to policymakers to drive change. And so translating that research, translating our experiences and our expertise is all part of the equation.
Because of your personal experience with firearms, do you notice that there's any sort of divide when we have conversations about gun control between people who own guns, use them legally, presumably, and people who don't own guns and aren't familiar with firearms?
I think there is an anecdotal divide in the kind of types of conversations people have and whether or not they're coming from a place of, you know, being armed with information to, you know, to participate in the latest of, oh, well, this firearm does this and this firearm does that. But when we look at the attitudes and opinions of gun owners versus non-gun owners, there's actually a lot of commonality. We recently looked at a bunch of surveys of both the public, you know, which included gun owners and non-gun owners, and we found overwhelming support for a number of firearm provisions, like prohibiting people who may be dangerously mentally ill from having firearms, universal background checks, extreme risk protection orders, the red flag laws that were recently passed and adopted in New York in 2019. So there's actually, I think, a lot more in common between gun owners and non-gun owners than the conversation or the political, you know, discourse would have us all believe. And on both sides, both from gun owners to non-gun owners and vice versa, education and information is going to be the key in finding those commonalities and finding those policies that we can agree upon.
Well, we've been speaking with Joe Popkin. He is the Director of Policy and Practice at the Rockefeller Institute and the Executive Director of the Regional Gun Violence Research Consortium. Joe, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, David. Have a great day.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.